Flashman at the Charge by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 2, Side 2. Then Nolan comes galloping up, full of zeal and gallantry, damn him, and shouted a message from the frogs, and I saw Raglan shake his head, and then he trotted off towards the river, with the rest of us dutifully tailing on behind. Willie had his sabre out, God knows why, for all we had to worry about just then was the Russian shot, which was bad enough. We spurred down to the river, myself keeping Willie at the tail of the group, and I saw Airy throw aside his plumed hat just as we took the water. There were bodies floating in the stream, which was churned up with mud, and the smoke was billowing down and catching at our throats, making the horses rear and plunge. I had to grip Willie's bridle to prevent his being thrown. On our left, men of the 2nd Division were crowded on the bank, waiting to go forward. They were retching and coughing in the smoke, and the small shot and balls were whizzing and whining by in a hideously frightening way. I just kept my head down, praying feverishly, as is my wont. And then I saw one of the other gallopers just ahead of me go reeling out of his saddle with the blood spouting from his sleeve. He staggered up, clutching at my stirrup and bawling, "I am perfectly well, my lord, I assure you." And then he rolled away, and someone else jumped down to see to him. Raglan halted, cool as you like, glancing right and left, and then summoned two of the gallopers and sent them pounding away along the bank to find Evans and Brown, whose divisions were being smashed to pieces at the foot of the bluffs. Then he says, "Come along, gentlemen, we shall find a vantage point," and cantered up the gully that opened up before us just there in the bluff face. For a wonder, it seemed empty, all the Ruskies being on the heights to either side, and the smoke was hanging above our heads in such clouds you couldn't see more than 20 yards up the hill. A hell of a fine position for a general to be in, you may think, and Raglan must have thought so too, for suddenly he spurred his horse at the hill to the left, and we all ploughed up behind him, scrambling on the shale and rough tufts, through the reeking smoke, until suddenly we were through it, and on the top of a little knoll at the bluff foot. I'll never forget that sight. Ahead, and to our left, rose the bluffs, bare steep hillside for 500 feet. We could see the Russian positions clear as day, the plumes of musket smoke spouting down from the trenches, and the bearded faces behind them. Directly to our left was a huge redoubt packed with enemy guns and infantry. There were other great batteries above and beyond. In front of the big redoubt, the ground was thick with the bodies of our men, but they were still swarming up from the river under a hail of firing. And beyond, along the bluffs, there was still advancing a great sprawling mass of scarlet coats and white cross-belts, clawing their way up, falling, scattering, reforming, and pressing on. For a mile, as far as one could see, they were surging up over that hellish slope with the dead scattered before them towards the smoking positions of the enemy. Better here than there, thinks I, until I realized that we were sitting up in full view, unprotected, with the Rusky infantry not 100 yards away. We were absolutely ahead of our own infantry, thanks to that fool Raglan, and he was sitting there with his blue coat flapping round him and his plumed hat on his head, as calm as if it were a review, clinging to his saddle with his knees alone, while he steadied his glass with his single arm. There was so much shot whistling overhead, we couldn't be sure whether they were firing on us with intent or not. And then, right up on the crest, above the batteries, we saw the Russian infantry coming down the slope, a great brown mass, packed like sardines, rank after rank of them. They came clumping slowly, inexorably down towards the batteries, obviously intent on rolling into our infantry below. They looked unstoppable, and Raglan whistled through his teeth as he watched them. "Too good to miss, by George," cried he, and turning, caught my eye. "Down with you, Flashman. Guns at once!" And you may understand that I didn't need telling twice. "Stay there!" shouts I to Willie, and then had my charger down that slope like a jackrabbit. There were gun teams labouring and splashing up the bank, and I bawled to them to make haste to the ridge. The horses were lashed up the muddy slope, the guns swinging wildly behind them. One of our gallopers got them positioned, with the gunners hauling them round by main force, and as I came back up the hill, none too swiftly, the first salvos were screaming away to crash into the flank of the Russian columns. It was havoc all along the bluffs, and smoking hell on that little hill. There were infantry pouring past us now, sweating, panting, smoke-blackened faces and bayonets thrust out ahead as they surged by and upwards towards the Russian positions. They were shrieking and bawling like madmen, heedless apparently of the bloody holes torn in their ranks by the Russian firing. I saw two of them suddenly turn into pulp as a fusillade struck them, and another lying screaming with a thigh shot away. I looked for Raglan and saw him with a couple of gallopers preparing to descend the hill. I looked for Willie, and there he was, his hat gone, shouting like a madman at the passing infantry. And then, by God, he whirled up his sabre and went flying along with them across the face of the slope towards the nearest battery. His horse stumbled and recovered, and he waved his sword and huzzaed. "Come back, you German lunatic!" I yelled, and Raglan must have heard me, for he checked his horse and turned. Even with the shot flying and the screaming and the thunder of the guns, with the fate of the battle in his hands, those ears which were normally deaf to sense caught my words. He saw me, he saw Willie, careering away along the bluffs among the infantry, and he sang out, "After him, Flashman!" Probably, addressed to any other man in the army, that order would have evoked an immediate response, the eye of the chief and all that. But I took one look along that shell-swept slope with the bodies thick on it and that young idiot riding through the blood and bullets, and I thought, by God, let him go for me. I hesitated, and Raglan shouted again angrily, so I set my charger towards him, cupping a hand behind my ear and yelling, "What's that, my lord?" he shouted and pointed again, stabbing with his finger. And then a shot mercifully ploughed up the ground between us, and as the dirt showered over me, I took the opportunity to roll nimbly out of the saddle. I clambered up again like a man dazed, and Rotim, he was still there and looking thoroughly agitated. "The Prince Flashman!" he bawls, and then one of the gallopers plucked at his coat and pointed to the right, and off they went, leaving me clutching at my horse's head, and Willie 100 yards away in the thick of the advancing infantry, setting his horse to the breastwork of the battery. It balked, and he reeled in the saddle, his sabre falling, and then he pitched straight back, losing his grip, and went down before the feet of the infantry. I saw him roll a yard or two, and then he lay still, as the advance passed over him. "Christ!" I thought, "he's done for." And as our fellows surged into the battery and the firing from above slackened, I picked my way cautiously along through those dreadful heaps of dead and dying and wounded, with the stink of blood and powder everywhere, and the chorus of shrieks and moans of agony in my ears. I dropped on one knee beside the little blue-clad figure among the crimson. He was lying face down. I turned him over and vomited. He had half a face, one glazed eye and brow and cheek, and on the other side just a gory mash, with his brains running out of it. I don't know how long I crouched there, staring at him, horror-struck. Above me I could hear all hell of firing and shouting still going on as the battle surged up the slope, and I shook with fear at it. I wasn't going near that again, not for a pension. But as I forced myself to look at what was left of Willie, I found myself babbling aloud, "Jesus, what'll Raglan say? I've lost Willie. My God, what will they say?" And I began cursing and sobbing, not for Willie, but out of shock, and for the folly and ill luck that had brought me to this slaughterhouse and had killed this brainless brat, this pathetic princeling who thought war was great sport, and had been entrusted to my safekeeping. By God, his death could be the ruin of me. So I swore and wept, crouched beside his corpse. Of all the fearful sights I have seen on this day, none has so wrung my heart as this. That's what Airy told Raglan when he described how he'd found me with Willie's body above the Alma. "Poor Flashman, I believe his heart is broken, but to see the bravest blade on your staff, an officer whose courage is a byword in the army, weeping like a child beside his fallen comrade, it is a terrible thing. He would have given his own life 100 times, I know, to preserve that boy." I was listening outside the tent flap, you see, stricken dumb with manly grief. Well, I thought, that's none so bad. Crying with funk and shock has its uses, provided it's mistaken for noble tears. Raglan couldn't blame me. After all, I hadn't shot the poor little fool, or been able to stop him throwing his life away. Anyway, Raglan had a victory to satisfy him, and even the loss of a royal galloper couldn't sour that, you'd think. Aye, but it could. He was all stern reproach when finally I stood in front of him, covered in dust, played out with fear, and doing me damnedest to look contrite, which wasn't difficult. "What?" says he in a voice like a church bell. "Will you tell Her Majesty?" "My lord," says I. "I am sorry, but it was no fault." He held up his one fine hand. "Here is no question of fault, Flashman. You had a sacred duty, a trust given into your hands by your own sovereign to preserve that precious life. You have failed utterly. I ask again, what will you tell the Queen?" Only a bloody fool like Raglan would ask a question like that, but I did my best to wriggle clear. "What could I have done, my lord? You sent me for the guns, and—" "And you had returned. Your first thought thereafter should have been for your sacred charge. Well, sir, what have you to say? Myself, in the midst of battle, had to point to where honour should have taken you at once, and yet you paused. I saw you, and—" "My lord," cries I, full of indignation, "that is unjust. I did not fully understand in the confusion what your order was. I—" "Did you need to understand?" says he, all quivering sorrow. "I do not question your courage, Flashman. It is not in doubt." "Not with me either," I thought. "But I cannot but charge you, heavily though it weighs on my heart, to do so with failing in that instinct for your first duty, which should have been not to me, or to the army even, but to that poor boy whose shattered body lies in the ambulance. His soul, we may be confident, is with God." He came up to me, and his eyes were full of tears, the maudlin old hypocrite. "I can guess at your own grief. It has moved not only Airy, but myself, and I can well believe that you wish that you, too, could have found an honourable grave on the field, as William of Sel has done. Better, perhaps, had you done so." He sighed, thinking about it, and no doubt deciding that he'd be a deal happier when he saw the Queen again to be able to say, "Oh, Flashy's kicked the bucket, by the way, but your precious Willie is all right." Well, fearful and miserable as I wasn't that far gone myself. He prosed on a bit about duty and honour and my own failure, and what a hell of a blot I'd put on my copybook. No thought, you'll notice, for the blot he'd earned, with those thousands of dead piled up above the Alma, the incompetent buffoon.
"I doubt not you will carry this burden all your life," says he, with gloomy satisfaction. "How it will be received at home, I cannot say. For the moment, we must all look to our duty in the campaign ahead. There, it may be, reparation lies."
He was still thinking about Flashy filling a pit, I could see.
"I pity you, Flashman, and because I pity you, I shall not send you home. You may continue on my staff, and I trust that your future conduct will enable me to think that this lapse, irreparable though its consequences are, was but one terrible error of judgment, one sudden dereliction of duty which will never, nay, can never, be repeated. But for the moment I cannot admit you again to that full fellowship of the spirit in which members of my staff are wont to be embraced."
Well, I could stand that. He rummaged on his table and picked up some things.
"These are the personal effects of your dead comrade. Take them and let them be an awful reminder to you of duty undone, of trust neglected, and of honour... No, I will not say aught of honour to one whose courage, at least, I believe to be beyond reproach."
He looked at the things. One of them was a locket which Willie had worn round his neck. Raglan snapped it open and gave a little gulp. He held it out to me, his face all noble and working.
"Look on that fair, pure face," cries he, "and feel the remorse you deserve. More than anything I can say, it will strike to your soul, the face of a boy's sweetheart, chaste, trusting, and innocent. Think of that poor, sweet creature who, thanks to your neglect, will soon be draining the bitterest cup of sorrow."
I doubted it myself as I looked at the locket. Last time I'd seen her, the poor sweet creature had been wearing nothing but black satin boots. Only Willie in this wide world would have thought of wearing the picture of a St. John's Wood whore around his neck. He had been truly wild about her, the randy little rascal. Well, if I'd had my way, he'd still have been thumping her every night instead of lying on a stretcher with only half his head. but I wonder if the preaching Raglan, or any of the pious hypocrites who were his relatives, would have called him back to life on those terms. Poor little Willie. Chapter 4. Well, if I was in disgrace, I was also in good health, and that's what matters. I might have been one of the 3,000 dead, or of the shattered wounded lying shrieking through the dusk along that awful line of bluffs. There seemed to be no medical provision, among the British anyway, and scores of our folk just lay writhing where they fell, or died in the arms of mates hauling and carrying them down to the beach hospitals. The Russian wounded lay in piles by the hundred round our bivouacs, crying and moaning all through the night. I can hear their sobbing, "Pajalsta, Pajalsta." Still, the camp ground was littered with spent shot and rubbish and broken gear among the pools of congealed blood. My stars, wouldn't I just like to take one of our ministers or street-corner orators or blood-lusting, breakfast-scoffing papas over such a place as the Alma Hills. Not to let him see, because he'd just tut-tut and look anguished and have a good pray and not care a damn. But to shoot him in the belly with a soft-nosed bullet and let him die screaming where he belonged. That's all they deserve. Not that I cared a fig for dead or wounded that night. I had worries enough on my own account, for in brooding about the injustice of Raglan's reproaches, I convinced myself that I'd be broke in the end. The loss of that mealy little German pimp swelled out of all proportion in my imagination, with the Queen calling me a murderer and Albert accusing me of high treason, and the Times trumpeting for my impeachment. It was only when I realised that the army might have other things to think about that I cheered up. I was feeling as lonely as the policeman at Herne Bay when I loafed into Billy Russell's tent and found him scribbling away by a storm lantern, with Lou Nolan perched on an ammunition box, holding forth as usual. "Two brigades of cavalry," Nolan was saying, "two brigades. Enough to have pursued and routed the whole back of them. And what do they do? Sit on their backsides because Lucan's too damn scared to order a bag of oats without a written order from Raglan. Lord Lucan, bah! Lord bloody Lucan, more like." "Hmm," says Billy, writing away, and glanced up. "Here, Flash, you'll know. Were the Highlanders first into the redoubt? I say yes, but Lou says not. Stevens ain't sure, and I can't find Campbell anywhere. What do you say?" I said I didn't know, and Nolan cried what the devil did it matter anyway. They were only infantry. Billy, seeing he would get no peace from him, threw down his pen, yawned, and says to me, "You look well used up, Flash. Are you all right? What's the matter, old fella?" I told him Willie was lost, and he said, "Aye, that was a pity. A nice lad," and I told him what Raglan had said to me. And at this, Nolan forgot his horses for a minute and burst out, "By God, isn't that of a piece? He's lost the best part of 5 brigades, and he rounds on one unfortunate galloper because some silly little ass, who shouldn't have been here at all, gets himself blown up by the Russians. If he was so blasted concerned for him, what did he let him near the field for in the first place? And if you was to wet-nurse him, why did he have you galloping your ass off all day? The man's a fool. Aye, and a bad general, what's worse. There's a Russian army clear away, thanks to him and those idle frogs, and we could have cut him to bits on this very spot. I tell you, Billy, this feller I'll have to go." "Come, Lou, he's won his fight," says Russell, stroking his beard. "It's too bad he's set on you, Flash, but I'd lose no sleep over it. Depend upon it, he's only voicing his own fears of what may be said to him. But he's a decent old stick and bears no grudges. He'll have forgotten about it in a day or so." "You think so?" says I, brightening. "I should hope so," cries Nolan. "Mother of God, if he hasn't more to think about, he should have. Here's him and Lucan between 'em have let a great chance slip. But by the time Billy here has finished telling the British public about how the matchless guards and stern Caledonians swept the Muscovite horde aside on their bayonet points..." "I like that," says Billy, winking at me. "I like it, Lou. Go on, you're inspiring." "Ah, bah, the old fool will be thinking he's another Wellington," says Lou. "Aye, you can laugh, Russell. Tell your readers what I've said about Lucan, though. I dare you. That'd startle him." This talk cheered me up, for after all it was what Russell thought and wrote that counted. And he never even mentioned Willie's death in his dispatches to the Times. I heard that Raglan later referred to it at a meeting with his generals, and Cardigan, the dirty swine, said privately that he wondered why the prince's safety had been entrusted to a common galloper. But Lucan took the other side and said only a fool would blame me for the death of another staff officer. And De Lacey Evans said Raglan should think himself lucky it was Willie he'd lost and not me. Sound chaps, some of those generals. And Nolan was right. Raglan and everyone else had enough to occupy them after the armour. The clever men were for driving on hard to Sevastopol, a bare 20 miles away. And with our cavalry in good fettle, we could obviously have taken it. But the frogs were too tired, or too sick, or too froggy, if you ask me, and days were wasted, and the Ruskies managed to bolt the door in time. What was worse, the carnage at Alma and the cholera had thinned the army horribly. There was no proper transport, and by the time we'd lumbered on to Sevastopol Peninsula, we couldn't have robbed a hen roost. But the siege had to be laid, and Raglan, looking wearier all the time, was thrashing himself to be cheerful and enthusiastic, with his army wasting, and winter coming, and the frogs groaning at him. Oh, he was brave and determined, and ready to take on all the odds. The worst kind of general imaginable. Give me a clever coward every time. Which, of course, is why I'm such a damn fine general myself. So, the siege was laid, the French and ourselves sitting down on the muddy, rain-sodden, gullied plateau before Sevastopol, the dismalest place on earth, with no proper quarters but a few poor huts and tents, and everything to be carted up from Balaclava on the coast 8 miles away. Soon the camp, and the road to it, was a stinking quagmire. Everyone looked and felt filthy. The rations were poor. The work of preparing the siege was cruel hard, for the men anyway, and all the bounce there had been in the army after Alma evaporated in the dank, feverish rain by day and the biting cold by night. Soon, half of us were lousy, and the other half had fever or dysentery or cholera, or all three. As some wag said, who'd holiday at Brighton if he could come to sunny Sevastopol instead? I didn't take any part in the siege operations myself, not because I was out of favour with Raglan, but for the excellent reason that, like so many of the army, I spent several weeks on the flat of my back, with what was thought at first to be cholera, but was in fact a foul case of dysentery and wind, brought on by my own hoggish excesses. On the march south after the Alma, I'd been galloping a message from Airy to our advance guard, and had come on a bunch of our cavalry who'd bushwhacked a Russian baggage train and were busily looting it. Like a good officer, I joined in, and bagged as much champagne as I could carry, and a couple of fur cloaks as well. The cloaks were splendid, but the champagne must have carried the germ of the Siberian pox or something, for within a day I was blown up like a sheep on weeds and spewing and skittering damnably. They sent me down to a seedy little house in Balaclava, not far from where Billy Russell was established, and there I lay sweating and rumbling and wishing I were dead. Part of it I don't remember, so I suppose I must have been delirious, but my orderly looked after me well, and since I still had all the late Willie's gear and provisions, not that I ate much until the last week, I did tolerably well. Better, at least, than any other sick man in the army. They were being carted down to Balaclava in droves, rotten with cholera and fever, lying in the streets as often as not. Lou Nolan came down to see me when I was mending and gave me all the gossip about how my old friend Fan Duberly was on hand, living on a ship in the bay, and how Cardigan's yacht had arrived and his noble lordship, pleading a weak chest, had deserted his light brigade for the comforts of life aboard, where he slept soft and stuffed his guts with the best. There were rumours, too, Lou told me, of Russian troops moving up in huge strength from the east, and he thought that if Raglan didn't look alive, he'd find himself bottled up in the Sevastopol Peninsula. But most of Lou's talk was a great harangue against Lucan and Cardigan. To him, they were the clowns who'd mishandled our cavalry so damnably and were preventing it earning the laurels which Lou thought it deserved. He was a dead bore on the subject, but I'll not say he was wrong. We were both to find out all about that shortly. For now, although I couldn't guess it, as I lay pampering myself with a little preserved jellied chicken and Rhine wine, of which Willie's store chest yielded a fine abundance, that terrible day was approaching, that awful thunderclap of a day when the world turned upside down in a welter of powder smoke and cannon shot and steel, which no one who lived through it will ever forget, myself least of all. I never thought that anything could make Alma or the Kabul retreat seem like a shallowbank picnic, but that day did. And I was through it, dawn to dusk, as no other man was. It was sheer bad luck that it was the very day I returned to duty. Damn that Russian champagne. If it had kept me in bed just one day longer, what I'd have been spared. Mind you, would have lost India, for what that's worth. I had been up a day or two, riding a little up to the Balaclava plain, and wondering if I was fit enough to look up Fan Duberly, and take up again the attempted seduction which had been so maddeningly frustrated in Wiltshire 6 years before. She'd ripened nicely, by what Lou said, and I hadn't bestrode anything but a saddle since I'd left England. Even the Turks didn't fancy the Crim-Tartar women. And anyway, I'd been ill. But I'd convalesced as long as I dared, and old Colin Campbell, who commanded in Balaclava, had dropped me a sour hint that I ought to be back with Raglan in the main camp, up on the plateau. So, on the evening of October the 24th, I got my orderly to assemble my gear, left Willie's provisions with Russell, and loafed up to headquarters. Whether I'd exerted myself too quickly, or it was the sound of the Russian bands in Sevastopol playing their hellish, doleful music that kept me awake, I was taken damned ill in the night. My bowels were in a fearful state. I was blown out like a boiler, and I was unwise enough to treat myself with brandy, on the principle that if your guts are bad, they won't feel any worse for your being foxed. They do, though, and when my orderly suddenly tumbled me out before dawn, I felt as though I were about to give birth. I told him to go to the devil, but he insisted that Raglan wanted me PDQ, so I huddled into my clothes in the cold, shivering and rumbling, and went to see what was up. They were in a great sweat at Raglan's post. Word had come from Lucan's cavalry that our advance posts were signalling enemy in sight to the eastward, and gallopers were being sent off in all directions, with Raglan dictating messages over his shoulder while he and Airy pored over their maps. "My dear Flashman," says Raglan when his eye lit on me, "why, you look positively unwell. I think you would be better in your berth." He was all benevolent concern this morning, which was like him, of course. "Don't you think he looks ill, Airy?" Airy agreed that I did, but muttered something about needing every staff rider we could muster. So Raglan tutted and said he much regretted it, but he had a message for Campbell at Balaclava. And it would be a great kindness if I would bear it. He really did talk like that most of the time. Consideration fairly oozed out of him. I wondered if I should plead my belly, so to speak, but finding him in such a good mood, with the Willie business apparently forgotten, I gave him my brave, suffering smile and pocketed his message. Fool that I was. I felt damned shaky as I hauled myself into the saddle and resolved to take my time over the broken country that lay between headquarters and Balaclava. Indeed, I had to stop several times and try to vomit, but it was no go, and I cantered on over the filthy road with its litter of old stretchers and broken equipment until I came out into the open ground some time after sunrise. After the downpour of the night before, it was dawning into a beautiful clear morning, the kind of day when, if your innards aren't heaving and squeaking, you feel like a fine gallop with the wind in your face. Before me, the Balaclava plain rolled away like a great grey-green blanket. And as I halted to have another unsuccessful retch, the scene that met my eyes was like a galloping field day. On the left of the plain, where it sloped up to the long line of the Causeway Heights, our cavalry were deployed in full strength, more than 1,000 horsemen, like so many brilliant little puppets in the sunny distance, trotting in their squadrons, wheeling and reforming. About a mile away, nearest to me, I could easily distinguish the light brigade, the pink trousers of the cherry pickers, the scarlet of light dragoons, and the blue tunics and twinkling lance points of the 17th. The trumpets were tootling on the breeze, the words of command drifted across to me as clear as a bell, and even beyond the lights I could see, closer in under the causeway and retiring slowly in my direction, the squadrons of the heavy brigade, the grey horses with their scarlet riders, the dark green of the skins, and the hundreds of tiny glittering slivers of the sabres. It was for all the world like a green nursery carpet with tiny toy soldiers deployed upon it, and as pretty as these pictures of reviews and parades that you see in the galleries. Until you looked beyond to where Causeway Heights faded into the haze of the eastern dawn, and you could see why our cavalry were retiring. The far slopes were black with scurrying ant-like figures, Russian infantry pouring up to the gun redoubts which we'd established along the 3 miles of the causeway. The thunder of cannon rolled continuously across the plain, the flashes of the Russian guns stabbing away at the redoubts, and the sparkle of their muskets was all along the far end of the causeway. They were swarming over the gun emplacements, engulfing our Turkish gunners, and their artillery was pounding away towards our retreating cavalry, pushing it along under the shadow of the heights. I took all this in and looked off across the plain to my right, where it sloped up into a crest protecting the Balaclava Road. Along the crest there was a long line of scarlet figures with dark green blobs where their legs should be. Campbell's Highlanders at a safe distance, thank God, from the Russian guns, which were now ranging nicely on the heavy brigade under the heights. I could see the shot plumping just short of the horses and hear the urgent bark of commands. A troop of the skins scattered as a great column of earth leaped up among them, and then they reformed, trotting back under the lee of the causeway. Well, there was a mile of empty, unscathed plain between me and the Highlanders, so I galloped down towards them, keeping a wary eye on the distant artillery skirmish to my left. But before I got halfway to the crest, I came on their outlying picket, breakfasting round a fire in a little hollow. And who should I see but little Fanny Dubley, presiding over a frying pan with half a dozen grinning Highlanders round her. She squealed at the sight of me, waving and shoving her pan aside. I swung down out of my saddle, bad belly and all, and would have embraced her, but she caught my hands at arm's length. And then it was Harry and Fanny, and where have you sprung from, and all that nonsense and chatter, while she laughed and I beamed at her. She'd grown prettier, I think, with her fair hair and blue eyes, and looking damn fetching in her neat riding habit. I longed to give her tits a squeeze, but couldn't, with all those leering Highlanders nudging each other. She'd ridden up, she said, with Henry, her husband, who was in attendance on Lord Raglan, although I hadn't seen him.
"Will there be a great battle today, Harry?" says she. "I'm so glad Henry will be safely out of it, if there is. See yonder!"
And she pointed across the plain towards the heights.
"Where the Russians are coming. Is it not exciting? Why do the cavalry not charge them, Harry? Are you going to join them? Oh, I hope you will take care. Have you had any breakfast? My dear, you look so tired. Come and sit down and share some of our haggis."
If anything could have made me sick, it would have been that. But I explained that I hadn't time to tattle, but must find Campbell. I promised to see her again as soon as the present business was by, and advised her to clear off down to Balaclava as fast as she could go. It was astonishing, really, to see her picnicking there as fresh as a May morning, and not much more than a mile away, the Russian forces pounding away round the redoubts, and doubtless ready to sweep right ahead over the plain when they'd regrouped. The sergeant of Highlanders said Campbell was somewhere off with a heavy brigade, which was bad news, since it meant I must approach the firing. But there was nothing for it, so I galloped off north again, through the extended deployment of the lights, who were now sitting at rest, watching the heavies reforming. George Paget hailed me. He was sitting with one ankle cocked up on his saddle, puffing his cheroot, as usual. "Have you come from Raglan?" cries he. "Where the hell are the infantry, do you know? We shall be sadly mauled at this rate unless he moves soon. Look at the heavies yonder. Why don't Lucan shift them back faster out of harm's way?" And indeed they were retiring slowly, it seemed to me, right under the shadow of the heights, with the Russian fire still kicking up the clods round them as they came. I ventured forward a little way. I could see Lucan and his staff, but no sign of Campbell, so I asked Morris of the 17th, and he said Campbell had gone back across the plain towards Balaclava a few minutes since. Well, that was better, since it would take me down to the Highlanders' position, away from where the firing was. And yet, it suddenly seemed very secure in my present situation, with the blue tunics and lances of the 17th all round me, and the familiar stench of horse flesh and leather, and the bits jingling, and the fellers patting their horses' necks and muttering to steady them against the rumble of the guns. There were troop horse artillery close by, banging back at the Russians. But it was still rather like a field day, with the plain all unmarked, and the uniforms bright and gay in the sunlight. I didn't want to leave them. But there were the Highlanders drawn up near the crest, across the plain southward. I must just deliver my message as quickly as might be, and then be off back to headquarters. So I turned my back to the heights, and set off again through the ranks of the 17th and the cherry pickers, and was halfway down the plain to the Highlanders on the crest, when here came a little knot of riders moving up towards the cavalry. And who should it be but my bold Lord Cardigan, with Squire Bruff and his other toadies, all in great spirits after a fine, comfortable, boozy night on his yacht. No doubt. I hadn't seen the man face to face since that night in Elspeth's bedroom, and my bile rose up even at the thought of the bastard, so I cut him dead. When Bruff hailed me and asked what was the news, I reined up, not even looking in Cardigan's direction, and told Bruff the Ruskies were overrunning the far end of the heights, and our horse were falling back. "Yes," says Cardigan to his toadies, "it is the usual foolishness. They are the Russians, so our cavalry move in the other direction. Ha, ha, ha. You there, Flashman, what does Ward Wagwan propose to do?" I continued to ignore him. "Well, Squire," says I to Bruff, "I must be off. Can't stand gossiping with yachtsmen, you know." And I wheeled away, leaving them gaping and an indignant "hua, hua" sounding behind me. But I hadn't time to feel too satisfied, for in that moment there was a new thunderous cannonade from the Russians, much closer now. The whistle of shot sounded overhead. There was a great babble of shouting and orders from the cavalry behind me. The calls of the lights and heavies sounded, and the whole mass of our horse began to move off westward, retiring again. The cannonading grew. As the Russians turned their guns southward, I saw columns of earth ploughed up to the east of the Highlanders' position, and with my heart in my mouth, I buried my head in the horse's mane and fairly flew across the turf. The shot was still falling short, thank God, but as I reached the crest, a ball came skipping and rolling almost up to my horse's hooves and lay there, black and smoking, as I tore up to the Highlander's flank. "Where is Sir Colin?" cries I, dismounting, and they pointed to where he was pacing down between the ranks in my direction. I went forward and delivered my message. "Out to date," says he, when he'd read it. "You don't look weel, Flashman. Bide a minute. I've a note here for Lord Raglan." And he turned to one of his officers, but at that moment the shouting across the plain redoubled. There was the thunderous plumping of shot falling just beyond the Highland position, and Campbell paused to look across the plain towards the Causeway Heights. "Aye," says he, "there it is." I looked towards the heights, and my heart came up into my throat. Our cavalry was now away to the left, at the Sevastopol end of the plain, but on the heights to the right, near the captured redoubts, the whole ridge seemed to have come alive. Even as we watched, the movement resolved itself into a great mass of cavalry, Russian cavalry, wheeling silently down the side of the heights in our direction. They've told me since that there were only four squadrons, but they looked more like four brigades, blue uniforms and grey, with their sabres out, preparing to descend the long slope from the heights that ran down towards our position. It was plain as a pikestaff what they were after, and if I could have sprouted wings in that moment, I'd have been fluttering towards the sea like a damned gull. Directly behind us, the road to Balaclava lay open. Our own cavalry were out of the hunt, too far off to the left. There was nothing between that horde of Russians and the Balaclava base, the supply line of the whole British army, but Campbell's few hundred Highlanders, a rabble of Turks on our flank, and flashy, full of wind and horror. Campbell stared for a moment, that granite face of his set. Then he pulled at his dreary moustache and roared an order. The ranks opened and moved and closed again. And now, across our ridge, there was a double line of Highlanders, perhaps a furlong from end to end, kneeling down a yard or so on the seaward side of the crest. Campbell looked along them from our stance at the right-hand extremity of the line, bidding the officers dress them. While they were doing it, there was a tremendous caterwauling from the distant flank, and there were the Turks, all order gone, breaking away from their positions in the face of the impending Russian charge, flinging down their arms and tearing headlong for the sea road behind us. "Dross," says Campbell. I was watching the Turks. And suddenly to their rear, riding towards us, and then checking and wheeling away southward, I recognised the fair hair and riding figure of Fanny Dubley. She was flying along as she passed our far flank, going like a little jockey. She could ride, that girl. "Damn all society women," says Campbell. And it occurred to me, even through the misery of my stomach and my rising fear, that Balaclava playing that morning was more like the Row, Fanny Dubley out riding, and Cardigan ambling about haw-hawing. I looked towards the Russians. They were rumbling down the slope, now a bare half-mile away. Campbell shouted again, and the long scarlet double rank moved forward a few paces, with a great swishing of their kilts and clatter of gear, and halted on the crest, the front rank kneeling, and the second standing behind them. Campbell glanced across at the advancing mass of the Russian horse, measuring the distance. 93rd, he shouted. There is no retreat from here. You must stand. He'd no need to tell me. I couldn't have moved if I'd wanted to. I could only gape at that wall of horsemen, galloping now, and then back at the two frail scarlet lines that in a moment must be swept away into bloody rabble, with the hooves smashing down on them and the sabres swinging. It was the finish, I knew, and nothing to do but wait, trembling for it to happen. I found myself staring at the nearest kneeling Highlander, a huge, swarthy fellow with his teeth bared under a black moustache. I remember noticing the hair matting the back of his right hand as it gripped his musket. Beyond him there was a boy gazing at the advancing squadrons with his mouth open. His lip was trembling. "Hold your fire until I give the word," says Campbell. And then quite deliberately he stepped a little out before the front rank and drew his broadsword, laying the great glittering blade across his chest. "Christ," I thought, "that's a futile thing to do." The ground was trembling under our feet now, and the great quadruple rank of horsemen was a bare 200 yards away, sweeping down at the charge, sabres gleaming, yelling and shouting as they bore down on us, a sea of flaring horse heads and bearded faces above them. "Present!" shouts Campbell, and moved past me in behind the front rank. He stopped behind the boy with the trembling lip. "You never saw the like of that coming down the gully gate," says he. "Steady now, 93rd. Wait for my command." They were 100 yards away now, that thundering tide of men and horses, the hooves crashing like artillery on the turf. The double bank of muskets with their fixed bayonets covered them. The locks were back, the fingers hanging on the triggers. Campbell was smiling sourly beneath his moustache. The madman. He glanced to his left along the silent lines. "Give the word, damn you, you damned old fool," I wanted to shout, for they were a bare 50 yards off, and a split second they'd be into us. He left it too late. "Fire!" he bellowed. And like one huge bark of thunder, the front rank volley crashed out, the smoke billowed back in our faces, and beyond it the foremost horsemen seemed to surge up in a great wave. There was a split second of screaming confusion, with beasts plunging and rearing, a hideous chorus of yells from the riders, and the great line crashed down on the turf before us, the men behind careering into the fallen horses and riders, trying to jump them or pull clear. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.